Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Dechra 2014 annual results presentation conference call. My name is Dave, and I'll be your coordinator for today's conference. For the duration of the call, you will be on listen only. However, at the end of the call, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions. If at any time you need assistance, please press star zero on your telephone keypad, and you'll be connected to an operator. I'm now handing you over to Ian Page, CEO, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everybody. As ever, we'll start with Anne-Françoise, who'll run us through the numbers. Then I'll come on and talk about the four key areas of our growth strategy a little bit later on in the presentation. And at the end, we'll have a questions and answer session.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian. Good morning, everyone. So if we look at 2014's result, as we progress on all four aspects of our strategy, which Ian will cover later, we've delivered a solid set of financial results, as you can see on slide two. During the year, we've achieved a balance between revenue growth and investments behind to support our strategic ambitions, at the same time as delivering good profit growth and improved operating leverage. Our revenue were almost 194 million pounds, which is a 1.6% growth at constant exchange rate. Now, to offset this modest sales growth, we've had an improved gross margin, which went up to 55.6%. And this flowed through the bottom line, where we reported an underlying operating profit of 42.2 million pounds, which is a 7% increase versus last year. Of note, you'll see straight away that we've delivered a very strong EPS at 0.3632 per share, above expectation, which is a 24% growth versus last year. And I'll cover in a minute the reasons for that. Finally, we've declared a dividend of  0.504 per share, which is a 10% increase versus last year and is in line with our dividend policy. In terms of the sales, we showed growth in most of our categories except food producing animal products, which declined by 7%. The companion animal products portfolio at 99 million pounds grew by 4%, and we saw growth in most of our categories, particularly in endocrinology, with a strong performance in the U.S., in ophthalmics, with the relaunch of Etrapolisin, and also in cardiovascular, with the success of CardiSure in Europe growing by 30%. For the first time, we've presented equine products separately. The first reason is so that Ian and I don't disagree or debate whether horses are companion animal or food producing animals, as we may have slightly different cultural biases. But also because looking forward at the future, equine will become increasingly important as we launch Orthros. In 2014, equine represented 13 million pounds, which is with a double-digit growth, driven by a product we acquired in January 2012 called HY50, which is for joint lameness, where we saw sales double across Europe. Large animal products portfolio has been disappointing, declining at 7% as anticipated, mostly due to competitive pressure in the Netherlands. Behind this decline, we are actually seeing growth in our smaller market of France, Spain, and Italy. So there is some momentum also coming from a smaller sales base in European countries. The diet performance at 28 million pounds has been fairly stable, which we're quite pleased about, given the fact that we are currently transferring to a manufacturer. And finally, third-party manufacturing at 18 million pounds continue to be a good revenue stream for the organization. Now, on slide four, for those of you on the line, I'll continue to analyze a little bit further our overall sales growth of 1.6%. And if you look at that total growth and break it down into its individual components, you will see that our core brands, in particular in EU, the CAP and equine portfolio, has grown by almost 2% of our total revenue growth, and the U.S. has grown by 1.6%, the core brand of Etrafilinazole in total, 1.6% of our total growth. Now, that means that our core portfolio has grown by 4%, but this has been offset by the decline in fat that I talked about earlier, and also by the supply issues around Animax, which we were still selling in 2013, and that impacted the growth by 1%. So the headwind, showed a decline of 2.4%. Now, you will recall that in the H1, we presented a decline in sales of almost 1% at constant exchange rate. We're pleased to report that in the second half, we saw a turn and a positive momentum, and sales were growing at 4% at constant exchange rate. So if you combine the growth on the core brands that I talked about earlier with the momentum in the second half, we are quite confident that we're starting the new financial year in a good position. Now, you saw on the first page in the summary P&L that the improvement in gross margins was a key driver of our improved profitability, and gross margins have moved from 53.2% up to 55.6%. There are two drivers, two reasons for that. The first one is the continued realizations of the Eurovet synergies, which represent about a third of the improvement, and that's mostly as the result of bringing in-house sales that we used to do through third-party distributors, particularly in Germany and France, where we realized a full year, retained the margin for a full year. The second reason is, of course, the product mix in the EU and in the US as we sell more companion animal products, which are higher value. From a segmental perspective, looking at the revenue for EU pharmaceuticals, we ended the year at £172 million, which is a 1% growth at constant exchange rate. Now, if you put this in the context of the market growth, where we know from the Vetnosis market analysis, the estimated market growth in Europe for 2013 was 0.5% at constant exchange rate. You can see that our performance in a difficult environment was actually pretty good at 1% and was above the market growth rate. We know that in Europe, the gross margin improved and that has flowed through the EBIT, where we reported an underlying EBIT at £49 million, which is a 6% growth at constant exchange rate. That also means that we've improved our operating leverage in Europe, moving from 27.2% in 2013 all the way to 28.4% at the end of the financial year 2014. In the US, similar picture, with sales growing to £21 million, a 7% growth. Again, if we adjust for Animax, the Animax supply issues, the underlying growth is in fact around 16%, so there is a strong momentum in the US. In the US, the picture is slightly different in terms of our profile, because we've invested in the US. We've increased our headcount over the years. We've increased our sales and marketing in line with the revenue growth. Having said that, having done all of that, we still see an improvement in operating leverage in the US, and the profit of £6 million result in an EBIT margin of 28.3%. Which is a 1 percentage point improvement versus last year. Now, on slide 9, for those of you on the line, I have talked several times, referred several times to the additional investments we've made to support our strategic ambition, and you can see that our SG&A expenses have gone up to £57 million. Some of the drivers are, you know, almost inherent to the business. It's inflation. It's a higher cost of LTIPs due to the share price appreciation. But there's also a few drivers where we made the decision internally to invest behind our growth. In particular, we've decided, as I just said earlier, to invest in the U.S. sales and marketing organization, which was an incremental cost of £0.8 million, which has driven incremental profit of, in percentage, the profit growth was 11%. In absolute term, we were talking about £1.4 million incremental profit, or £600,000, net of the investment. So it's, again, a very good return on our investment. The second driver of the increasing cost is our investment behind tax advice in particular, which you will see later on has driven a strong an improvement in the effective tax rate and a tax savings of £1 million. So whilst our SG&A currently is at about 30% of sales, we still believe it's very efficient and very lean if we compare it to our peer group benchmarks, where the average for the industry, the average SG&A spend as a percentage of sales is nearer to 35%. There is no doubt that we've had a very strong EPS performance, slightly above expectations. And that's driven by our operational results that I've just explained, but also by a few actions taken from a financial management perspective. In particular, we repaid our debt in September 2013, our fixed-term debt, and that resulted in interest savings of £2.6 million, which, you know, to the EPS added almost 4 pence per share. Similarly, I'll talk about it in a minute. We've taken a lot of action to optimize our tax position, and I've delivered savings of £1 million in the year, adding a little bit over 1 pence per share to the EPS. When we did the divestment from services in August last year, it was very clear that a fair portion of our profits were realized in Europe. And to me, it was clear that assessing our tax position was a key priority in order to make sure that we limit our exposure to higher tax rates in the rest of Europe. So you will see that as a result of that all that work, our effective tax rate has moved from 24% down to 20%. Now, 1 percentage point of that decrease in tax rate is due to prior adjustments. So the number I would really like you to focus on is the 21%. And the reason for the improvement is twofold. One, I must admit, there is an improvement or reduction in corporate tax rates in the UK and in Denmark. But more importantly, the result of our tax strategy has driven a 2.5 percentage points improvement in taxes. What we have been able to do is claim R&D tax credits and maximize the use of government-backed incentive schemes. And we've also been able to claim, but to a lesser extent, under the patent box legislation in the UK. Once we've addressed the tax strategy position, we, of course, moved our attention to Treasury. The first easy step, shall I say, was to repay our fixed-term debt in September with the proceeds from services, which meant that at the end of the year, we were in a positive net cash position at £2.7 million, before the acquisition of Ficox. Obviously, we acquired Ficox, and Ian will talk about it later on, which meant by the end of the year, we were in a net debt position of £5 million. In terms of our financing, I'm pleased to report that as of last week, we entered into a new banking facility, and we've completed a new RCF facility of £90 million with HSBC as a lead bank, Barclays and RBS as a new bank supporting DECRA. Now, the reason to do that is obviously to take advantage of favorable market conditions. So with the new facilities, we'll reduce our future cost of banking in a way, or interest cost. But we've also increased the funding headroom that is available to us that helps support our strategic objective. And more importantly, we extended the maturity profile of our debt from October 16 to September 19. So I believe as well that Lloyds and Handelsbanken are on the phone, and I want to take the opportunity to thank them for the support over the years as we are now moving with a different syndicates of bank. The next step obviously would be to look at our cash management and make sure we centralize our cash facilities across the group. Finally, a few words on working capital, because it's not clear, just not looking at the numbers, what the movements are behind numbers and what the story is behind the numbers. But I wanted to highlight that as the group changes, as the group evolves, it does impact our working capital position. So for instance, when we enter into Italy, then we increase our inventory. When we acquire Ficox, we acquire inventory. NVS is now a third-party customer, like any other customers, and that has increased our working capital. In this particular financial year, this is slightly offset by exchange rates, which actually has reduced has had a favorable impact on working capital in a way, and that means that overall working capital has increased by £4 million. So in summary, we've delivered a strong financial performance driven by gross margin improvements. We've put in place foundations in terms of our tax and our treasury activities, and we have a strong balance sheet moving forward. And it's really by focusing on the execution of our strategy that we will continue to deliver solid financial results. So I'll hand over to Ian at this point so he can talk you through the progress we've made on our strategy.
Thanks, Anne. As we outlined last year, we've redefined our strategy. We've got 4 major growth pillars, and I'll take each one of them in turn to let you know the progress. First of all, looking at portfolio focus in Europe, And really, I think what we're trying to demonstrate here is what Anne's already told you, that in the second half of the year, we really started to see some positive momentum in terms of growth. And if you take our key countries of the UK, Germany and France, you can see strong growth in each of those territories. This has been offset by a decline in the Netherlands, which was across our portfolio, particularly in farm animal antibiotics, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a moment. Also, what you have to take into consideration when looking at the underlying growth within Europe is that we had a problem in diagnosing vetrel within the year. New cases of vetrel have to be diagnosed using a drug known as Synaxan within Europe. That product went off the market. We responded really, really quickly, and we made a competitive product under a specials license in our manufacturing facility in Skipton, and every major regulatory authority in Europe other than one allowed us to market that product to help with the diagnosis. So we addressed the product very, very quickly, but it did have a negative effect on the growth of vetrel, particularly in the first half. Looking at the US, again, excellent momentum in the second half. The first quarter was affected by the washout of Animax, and we do hope to see that product again sometime in the 2015 calendar year. We managed to finally relaunch the ophthalmics as well in the final quarter. So the underlying performance, particularly of our key drugs, was very, very strong. And as Anne's already mentioned, we continue to invest in people, and the acquisition of PSBC again gave us critical mass that's allowed us to increase the infrastructure within this important market. Farm animal products have come under pressure. We're only in the antimicrobial section, antibiotics. As I'm sure you're all aware, there's a big issue in terms of utilization of antibiotics, and there's a belief that big usage of antibiotics in animals will have a crossover resistance effect on antibiotics within humans, MRSA. To that end, we have seen different governments putting pressure on the use of antibiotics, and Holland is something we've talked about a lot. The Netherlands, they've reduced significantly by over 50% now in the last 3 years, the use of antibiotics. We believe there has to be a base level that they must get to soon. They were one of the worst offending nations because they've got intensive farming. They did use a lot more antibiotics per head of livestock than a lot of other countries. But nonetheless, we have seen a big decline in antibiotics in this country. Where does this affect Dechra going forward? Well, Germany is probably the only country we feel that we've got any susceptibility to. That's the only country we have a reasonably large market share. There is no immediate evidence that there is a lot of government pressure, but I think it's prudent to assume that we will see a decline in antibiotic usage in Germany. On the positive side, as I mentioned earlier, we are seeing growth in a lot of our smaller countries where we have very low market share, so we can address the decline in the overall usage by increasing market share. Looking at things on a more geographical, wider scope, there is no doubt that high-quality protein is increasing in volumes, particularly in the emerging and developing markets. And it's also very evident that they like European-sourced pharmaceuticals because we are seen to be the better quality pharmaceuticals because of the regulatory approach rather than the home-produced products. So we've started to continue to invest in new registrations in overseas markets, and we've put more resource into our regulatory team just to focus on geographical registrations. The most important part of our strategy is the pipeline, and I'm delighted that we've launched Osfos within the last month. And I'll come on to talk about that in a little while. As we've already said, we've got Vetropolisin and Vetropolisin HC approved in the US. There's also a third ophthalmic product that is also in the regulatory approval's hand at the moment. Other major developments is our novel canine endocrine product. We've submitted the dossiers in both the EU and the USA, and we also have another narrow spectrum antibiotic also within the regulatory authorities within Europe. A small negative on the year is we've suspended a trial on a feline endocrinology drug. We had concerns over the formula, and we're addressing now, and we'll reach a decision on what we're going to do with this within the next few months. We've introduced four new products into the pipeline, and in the appendices you will see a list of our complete major pipeline and everything we have in development. We're also constantly reviewing new opportunities, and we've got some exciting opportunities that we're looking at the moment and evaluating as to whether they can become new candidates. Coming back to Osfos, excellent new addition for us. It's been approved by the FDA and the UK VMD. Osfos is a chronic condition affecting four limbs of horses. It's a very common condition, and one in three of all four limb lamenesses is caused by navicular syndrome. We've got a very efficacious and very safe product. The classification of compounds that clodronate fits in have historically been very difficult for horses because they cause chronic colic. Our product has very low incidence of colic and is very safe. From an efficacy perspective, when we were doing the clinical trial, veterinarians had horses that were placeboed and also on Osfos. And the vets told us within 3 or 4 days they knew which horses were on Osfos. It was that effective. So we have a terrific product we're delighted to have been able to launch. To pick up on Anne's cultural differences point, the French eat horses, whereas we don't know we do. The upshot of that is that the horse is classed as a food producing species within Europe, so we've had to do supplementary studies for maximum residue limits. They've all been completed, and the central dossier has now been submitted for the rest of Europe, and we hope to see the product launched across Europe sort of this time next year, hopefully. We've also submitted in Canada and Australia, two other countries where there's a potential reasonable sized opportunity for the product. As I already said, we've launched within the US, and I'm pleased to say one distributor has already reordered. We're about to launch in the UK. We're doing a pre-launch this week at the British Equine Veterinary Association Congress in Birmingham. There's an example for those that are techie on my laptop of some interactive marketing that'll give you a good explanation of bifosphonates and navicular disease. I'm sure you'll all be interested in to look at afterwards. In terms of geographical expansion, we've opened a new subsidiary in Italy. I'll come on to that in a second. We've also appointed a country manager for Canada. We've terminated the first of the distribution agreements in Canada and we'll start marketing our own products next year. The model is very simple, that the margin that's retained by our distributors is greater than it will cost us to actually run our own subsidiary. And of course, if you market the products yourselves, we believe that we can increase sales growth above and beyond a partner who wasn't necessarily focused on our portfolio. We're also looking at other territories. We've got one territory lined up for next year that we hope to enter, and we're looking at other opportunities in the future. In terms of Italy, it was our first greenfield startup since the US in 2004. Trading's running as expected. We were fortunate enough that Novartis bought Janssen. Janssen used to be the marketing partner for our key products in Italy, so we're able to take some of their senior management to come and run our Italy subsidiary. So they all already understand the products, they already understand the market. We will also see later next year our farm animal products return in Italy, and again, it will be a benefit then from taking the additional margin that we currently give to our distribution partner. In terms of acquisitions, we've screened a number of businesses, we've developed relationships with a number of businesses, and if you look at most of the acquisitions we've made over the years, they have been about developing relationships and getting to the point over a reasonably extended period of time to actually persuade them to sell the business to us. And that even applies to PSPC that we bought within this year, that with that business, we've known the owner for a number of years. In terms of expectations, a lot of you are aware that Eli Lilly, Novartis, acquired Novartis and Lohmann and paid very high multiples. There is a high expectation from the value of animal health companies, but we think this is a short-term blip, and we think that we will be able to find value in the not-too-distant future. We made one small acquisition within the year. As I've already said, it adds critical mass to our US business. It brings predominantly two products, one that already achieved sales of $4.5 million, which is a long-term patented nutraceutical for joint health in dogs and horses. They achieved $4.5 million of sales before we acquired it, but this was with very little sales and marketing support. The product really sold itself because of the technical benefits over the other products in the market that are nearly all glucosamine and chondroitin based, as opposed to phytocyanin, which our product contains. Levocrine is the product we're about to launch that comes from PSPC. This is a levothyroxine product. We already market levothyroxine very successfully within Europe under a Thyron brand, and that will be launched in the US and complements our existing endocrine portfolio. In terms of a number of the building blocks behind the business, first of all, looking at manufacturing, we've invested heavily in developing and increasing the scale of our liquids, creams and ointments suite in our Skipton site. And we've also been working very hard to get FDA approval for a new dosage form for our injectable suite, which is required for the new canine endocrine drug that we hope to launch next year. Once we've got FDA approval for the injection suite, we'll also be then looking to extend approval, FDA approval, into the liquids, creams and ointment suite that we've just developed. This will add, we've already got FDA approval for tablets and capsules, for those of you that don't know. In terms of logistics, we've spent $2 million over the last 2 years on extending and doubling the footprint of our distribution centre in Jutland. By doing this, we've trebled pallet handling capabilities, so that will serve all the group's logistic capabilities into the near future. In terms of IT, we've introduced a network across the group, a secure tight network. We're also investing still in Oracle. We've got Oracle live now in both our manufacturing facilities, and we'll roll it out as an ERP system across the group throughout the next couple of years. People we continue to invest in, following the disposal of our services segments. We restructured the management team to create a senior executive team that acts as an operating board for the group, and we've appointed a new HR director who is going to deliver a new people strategy throughout the group. To summarise, looking at the outlook, as we've hopefully demonstrated, we got good positive momentum in the second half of the year. We're seeing that continue into the beginning of the new financial year. Pipeline is delivering. Osphos is a big addition to our portfolio, and we'll have new products coming through over the next couple of years. We're making progress geographically, not least with Italy and Canada, but we're also looking at expanding our export sales with investment into registrations in third-party countries. And as Anne said, we have a very strong balance sheet. We have a number of acquisition opportunities under review, and hopefully we'll bring you more news on that in the not-too-distant future. So we continue to have a belief that we're delivering the right strategy and we're strengthening our position as a global animal health player. Okay, as I said, relatively short, so time for questions. Nick?
Just on tax, obviously it's a good level you're going to down to straight away. Going forward, I know you're guiding to the 21% level. Is there any chance that you could see further work lowering that rate over the next couple of years? And have you got a medium-term guide, like target in mind as far as tax rates are concerned?
So in the short term, being, say, next year, the financial year 15 and possibly 16, I will guide around the 21% that we have here. Because in the tax savings we've received, a little bit was prior year claims, you know, going back into past years. We are doing other tax optimization projects, which will deliver, but it will sort of offset the one-off claims we had of past benefits. The one big thing to come is more benefits from the patent box, which will be with OSPOS in particular. We believe that will fall under the patent box on the canine endocrinology. But for it to be material, we need to wait for the ramp up, and therefore that's more in 17-18. So I expect further tax savings, but once the new pipeline ramps up and delivers, to be material and affect the tax line, they would fall under the patent box. And therefore I would expect the tax rate to fall a little bit more, by a further 1% or 2%.
In terms of geographical expansion, you've got the portfolio to go direct yourself in terms of the critical mass.
Only in certain countries.
In certain countries. Now, is it because the acquisition multiples that are out there are obviously a high at the moment, but in terms of the risks and rewards of actually buying something to make sure you get that footprint straight away or going yourself, how are you making that decision in-house?
Well, there's very few countries where we do actually have enough critical mass so that the margin would cover the infrastructure you'd require, so it's not like we have a plethora of them to go at.
Right, okay.
So I think in most other countries it's either two options. We continue to develop our own registrations to gain that critical mass, or if there are strategic acquisitions that make sense, then we'll clearly look at that, but I don't think it's an exact science.
Right, okay. And then in terms of PSBC and the nutraceutical,
yeah,
talk a bit more about the competition, because obviously it's a big market compared to the sales you're doing now, and what's, you know, is there anything stopping you from going for a bigger part of the market?
No, there's nothing to stop us going for a bigger part of the market. Nearly every product is based on MSM or chondroitin or glucosamine. I don't know if you're familiar with these products.
Yeah.
They use a lot for humans with the arthritis type products. We have something called phycocyanin, which is derived from blue-green algae. We can't make this claim, but we know it acts like a COX-2 inhibitor. Because it's not a fully FDA-approved product, we can't actually make that claim. But there's enough studies been done in the marketplace that substantiate the effectiveness of it, as opposed to the two, you know, the two common molecules of glucosamine and chondroitin. So we do believe with just the sales focus that we have by a team of people, which PSBC didn't have, that we can increase market share.
Who is promoting those other products?
Oh, there's numerous companies.
Okay.
Numerous companies. I think Novartis had one. There's Corsican. There's numerous brands, and there's a lot of small players that just focus on nutraceuticals. There's one or two of the bigger pharmaceutical companies will have nutraceuticals, but there's numerous players, very genericized.
You mentioned in Holland and the Netherlands that the intensive farming methods used there were the main reason that the antibiotic usage was very high.
Yes.
It's now dropping from a high level. So what's changing in the Netherlands? Are the farming methods becoming less intensive? Or?
No, they're very simple. The government told the vets if they didn't get their house in order, they would take the right to dispense away from them. So, and of course, vets make a lot of profit from selling pharmaceuticals, and it was seen as a little counterintuitive that they were making profit from things that they were overprescribing. So they did two things. First of all, they told the vets, if you don't get your house in order, and significantly, they set them targets, and then they reset another target, and the vets have achieved that. But what they also did was introduce something called a formulary, which tells them which antibiotic to use in which condition, in which species, and it's very, very clearly defined there. So, but they're way ahead of any other government in doing that. There's nobody else put that sort of pressure or targeted focus within the country.
So the efficiency in terms of administration.
No, over prescription. Mm. So as soon as you got antimicrobial, as soon as they saw any disease, just, you know, feed, put antibiotics in the drinking water. Whereas now that they're targeting it more specifically and using narrower spectrum antibiotics and not these broad spectrum antibiotics that kill all.
Okay. Secondly, in terms of osmosis, you mentioned clearly the efficacy. What's the incumbent drug that is now?
In a few countries, there is another biphosphonate that's marketed by Ceva that's available, I think, in three European countries. But it has a recommendation for bone spavin, so it's used for navicular disease off-label. In the US, that drug has also been launched, but has had very little uptake because the incidence of chronic is very high and the efficacy is very low. So really we're creating a new market, and hence the really advanced marketing materials that we've got on my laptop to explain to vets, you know, how to treat the disease, what the incidence of the disease is. The other difference is that biphosphonates previously, the previous time that they've been used, they have to infuse them slowly into a horse over half an hour through a drip feed system. Ours is just an injection. So again, considerably easier to administer.
Clodronate is not approved for human use in the US, so you can't get any...
Not in its same dosage form, no. Clodronate is used in humans.
So is there any expectation that exposure to VET?
Off-label? I don't think so. We have patents anyway.
Any update at all on the synergy target for Eurovet? I mean, some time into that process now. Is that going on?
I think we've achieved everything, more or less. There's a little bit more to come through. We've just transferred Fathiron and Cardissure into Skipton, so that was the last of the synergies we'd identified in the prospectus, but we've delivered ahead of, I think, what we said we would when we bought the business.
We had said we would deliver €6 million over a three-year period, and we've certainly delivered more, and you can see in the current financial results it has helped the margins, so I think we're pretty much there.
The reason why I'm asking is that, obviously, you know me and my back to the envelope calculations. If I look at slide 6, we're talking about an EU product mix improvement in gross margin of 1.1%. So, you know, given the fact that's likely to come from sales synergies, i.e. putting companion animal product into the channel of Eurovet, that would imply some sort of, you know, a couple of million or so additional gross margin coming from that particular, you know, obviously usage of the channel and using your existing product range. Is that, am I just overreaching here, or, you know,
thank
you, you're getting at, or you know, significantly more than 6 million?
You may need a new little back of the envelope calculation. The Eurovet synergy is actually the 0.7%. So the 1.1% you see on slide 6 is truly product mix and the importance of cat, the relative proportion of the companion animal sales versus fat. The synergies are identified separately on this slide on the other 0.7, and it's simply the fact that we've had a full year of synergies compared to 13, which was partway through the year, bringing, you know, those distribution contracts
so
in-house.
There's no sales synergies at all in that 1.1%. That's clean.
Correct.
In terms of kind of stretch of the business, in terms of Betrol, Imazole, and generics, where do you see?
We've seen generic. There is generics now to Flimazole. This was made by a Dutch company, and in Holland that they've taken a chunk of market share off us. In every other country, they sell through distributors that don't have the same margin, so haven't been able to decimate the price the same, and we've hardly had any negative effect in most other countries. So we've had a great defensive strategy that we had in place, knowing that we were going to see generics. One of them was, if you remember at the half year, I told you about a low dose Flimazole that we got registered. Flimazole is all about getting the exact dosage right for each individual cat, so that the day that the generics appeared on the market, we launched a 1.25 milligram, which clearly the generic companies didn't have. So, you know, that differentiated our product and allowed us to maintain market share in every market other than Holland. Veteril has European patents. It has another couple of years marketing exclusivity within the US. The thing with Veteril is that it's not going to be easy to copy. Two reasons: trying to source the active and get the active micronized in the way to get the dissolution to the right level is very difficult. But the other thing to bear in mind is when you do a generic of something, you do something called a relative bioequivalence. And when you have every dog responding differently, it's very, very difficult to prove relative bioequivalence. So I think the most likely route that we'll ever see a copy for Veteril will be somebody doing a clinical study to create a comparable product. But again, we are working on defense strategies for that product.
In terms of Europe and antibiotics, I suppose the real question is, what is the real difference between prescribing patents in Holland and Germany? So, you know, you talked about intensive farming, but if you've done any internal analysis to look at what the prescribing rates are like per herd,
Yeah, well, we haven't done it. The European Medicines Evaluation Agency have actually done a log. You can find it online that shows use of antibiotics and type of antibiotics on a country-by-country basis.
And is there any significant difference there to suggest that Germany wouldn't be a risk?
I can't remember. No, I've already said Germany will be a risk, but less of a risk than Holland.
Yeah.
But at the moment, the main thing is there's no government intervention. There's government advice, but there's no government intervention, as we saw in Holland. Whether that comes or not, I'm not entirely sure. There's certainly been a lot of talk in Germany.
And how is it going to work, Ian, from a political standpoint, that now there's obviously muted changes to guidelines of imported meat from the US, which would allow the importation of meat significantly more antibiotic residual? When European farmers are going to be missing out, is it not going to...
I think you're mixing two issues. Your antibiotics have a meat and milk withholding period, so there's no residual antibiotics in the meat that's coming across. It's a different issue. That's what you have an MRL for, to prove that the meat is free of antibiotics by the time it's gone on the market. So every drug has a withholding period.
So what is the change that is coming through in from the importation of US meat?
Don't know. I think it's probably a separate issue. I think the thing with US meat is more related to the fact that they still give hormones, particularly in beef. So hormones were banned here 20 years ago. But I don't know about I don't know the issue you're referring to. So.
Is this from gaining share in the smaller markets in Europe? Can you just describe the dynamic there and how you're managing to take share in the country?
Probably because it's from a very low base in the first place. It's just we got into the farm animal medicine because to be a global player, we have to have that best business. Because if you look outside of Western Europe and North America, they're all farm animal medicine markets. So it is a market we want to be in. But when we bought Eurovet, the only markets they had any real significant share were Germany, Holland and Belgium. So in all the other markets, as we started to invest in more sales and marketing and just by gaining market penetration, there's nothing more than that. We're just starting from a very low base.
And I think the other thing I would add to that is a little bit to Sarah's previous point, is the Eurovet synergies. We're bringing those contracts in-house. So for instance, Italy, the new products coming back in-house are farm animal products, and that's what will drive a bit of the growth next year.
Question on your kind of financial I think you had debt facilities previously with up to 60 million.
It'd be yes.
What drove that? Is there anything specific to your
Our previous debt facility was £65 million. We've moved to £90 million, and really it was to lock in a facility at a favourable exchange rate. So by moving to £90 million, there's no additional cost, even if you take into account the non-utilisation fees, and it gives us the flexibility to look at the future that Ian has outlined without any additional cost.
In terms of the revenue growth rates, H1, H2, can you see what the like-for-like pricing component was in each one?
Well, most of our pricing goes up at the beginning of the year, so pretty comparable. So it isn't because we've hiked the prices up that we've had a better second half performance, if that's what you're asking. But the pricing, as I said, we started, so we've put in our major markets, the prices go up in August or September. So there will be a comparable first half and second half, but we'd normally inflate on most of the range, not the farm animal antibiotics, but on most of the companion and equine products, 2.5 to 3% per annum.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up. If I look at the FA dividend, was there a significant deterioration in Q4? Just by my use of back of the envelope, I'm calculating that went down by circa 16% compared to what it was, 4.7% decline in the first 9 months of the year.
I cannot answer directly to that question in terms of a quarterly growth rate. I would say in the last quarter, we had significant export orders, in particular to Poland and Russia, and therefore we didn't see a slowdown in momentum, but I can double check and come back to you. We didn't see, on the contrary, I would say FAP sales have picked up towards the back end of the year because they were slow in the first half. And you know, export is a major component of the FAP antibiotic sales.
Okay. Thanks very much, everybody. Anybody online got any questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you change your mind and want to withdraw your question, please press star 1 again. You will be advised when to ask your question. But just as a reminder, if you have a question or comment, please press star 1 now. We currently have no questions on the phone lines. I'll hand you back to your host. Thank you.
Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Your interest. Thanks. Goodbye.
Thank you for joining today's call. You may now replace your handset.